I'm Mike Cheslick. I'm the director of Hundreds of Beavers.
I am Quinn Hessler, and I'm the director of photography of Hundreds of Beavers.
And you're watching the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, Ilya.
Hey, Ben. How's it going?
It's going super duper. How about yourself?
It's going super duper for me too. Who's on the show today, Ben?
We have the filmmaking team behind the really awesome independent film, Hundreds of Beavers.
It is getting a lot of buzz right now. And someone asked me when I mentioned Hundreds of Beavers, they said, is that a porn film?
No.
It is not. Hundreds of Beavers. I was like, it's not a nature documentary either. What is Hundreds of Beavers?
Hundreds of Beavers is like basically a live action Warner cartoon.
That sounds amazing.
Directed by Mike Cheslick. And we have him and his DP on, Quinn Hester. And it's bonkers. It's just ripshit bonkers. And it's a movie that's done on a relatively low budget. I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say I think it was done for $150,000.
Wow.
And
that's an accomplishment. That's really tough to do.
And they shot it in the freezing cold in real ice. But what I love about this movie is that there is like no technique that they don't use. A lot of compositing. There are miniatures. And as you'll hear when in the interview, it was like extensively, I don't know if I would call it pre-vised because that would probably cost more than their entire budget. But the director did extensive like storyboards, animatics. They knew every piece of that film that they were going out to make before they went to make it. And it looks, it's black and white. And, you know, when we're dealing with animals and there's not just beavers, there's raccoons and other creatures. They look like mascot suits, like what you would see walking around at a theme park.
Wow.
And it's just pure fun. I just can't say enough good things about it, and I can't recommend it highly enough to anyone who just wants to see a fucking entertaining film.
That sounds awesome.
And now, Close Focus.
All right, Ben, we were talking right before we hit record. It's sort of an interesting week of stuff, but you've got a soapbox. You've got a thing you want to get on here. What should our close focus be to this?
There's kind of an old man shakes fist at cloud moment with the Russo brothers, who have said things that I've disagreed with strongly before. You know, I think they're great directors, and I'm not trying to denigrate them in any way. But they did an interview recently with Variety where they're basically saying that superhero fatigue isn't the problem, that the problem is that young people have ADHD and don't feel like watching a movie for 2 hours. And I actually want to say, as someone who's seen, I think, most of the MCU films, the fatigue is real. I think the fatigue is real. I recently showed the original Iron Man, which is sort of the jumping off point of the MCU, even if it wasn't intended to be that at the time. But I showed it to my son, and he was glued to the original Iron Man. And I was watching it, and I was like, how awesome is it to watch this movie? This is just a movie telling a story. It is a superhero story. It doesn't feel like IP with a capital I and a capital P. It doesn't feel like it's laying down 100 Easter eggs and paying off 100 previous Easter eggs. It doesn't feel overly precious about what it is. It just feels like, I think, what it is, which is Jon Favreau and Robert Downey Jr. and Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, et cetera, kind of bullshitting their way through the story. I mean, you can read stories about the making of Iron Man, but it basically had almost no script and they were making it up every day. And it was a lot of it was ad-libbed. And that was actually one of the things that made Favreau a natural director for it, because now we think of Jon Favreau as the mastermind behind The Mandalorian and some of these other amazing things he's done. But back then he was kind of known for movies like Elf.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I think that there was a lot of looseness on the set, but tight visual construction. And I feel like the further you get into the MCU, I mean, like the recent Marvel movies, you can't ever criticize the audience. You don't get to do that. It's not that this generation doesn't go to movies.
They do.
I do think that post-COVID, it is a little more challenging to get people to go to movies. I think that movies were, at one point, they were the pulse of culture, and they aren't that as much anymore, unfortunately. Makes me sad, because I love going to movies. We wouldn't be doing this podcast if we didn't both love films. But I also think that the MCU and DC, to a degree, have beaten it to death. And the MCU, I think, did something that sounds impossible on paper, and they did it very successfully for a long time, which was to tell all of these stories in a very interconnected way and to have them be basically one giant mega story that runs through all of the Avengers characters and the Guardians of the Galaxy, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, later in the MCU, I do think things like Guardians of the Galaxy were like a sudden bright light. And it's why? Because nobody had any expectations of the Guardians of the Galaxy. And James Gunn went and made an amazing movie that like took these characters nobody cared about and put them front and center. But like the more precious it got, where everything has to be perfectly stage managed, I feel like that's where it kind of falls off the rails. And I can't speak to the Marvels because I didn't see it. Or Eternals, but I feel like my interest personally just kind of went away. And I'm not Gen Z, you know. I'm a crusty old Gen X moviegoer who loves to go see stuff like this. I went and saw Dune and Barbie and The Batman and Oppenheimer and, you know, all the movies that we talk about on here. I've seen them all. But at a point, it was like they just kind of all felt like more of the same. And we're spoiled because more of the same is top flight visual effects and amazing pre-visualization and, you know, storyboards by our friend Tony Liberatore, probably. But at a certain point, it was like, I'm not getting anything new out of this universe. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I've got two thoughts. One, if you keep raising the bar and then you make a couple of movies that don't raise the bar, or actually the bar gets lower, you know, the audience isn't always going to give you a pass on that. If you do something that is particularly noteworthy and particularly good, you know, you've set expectations that you're going to be able to at least do that again, or they're hoping that you're going to one-up it. Marvel did a really good job with that. They started out strong with Iron Man, and they actually did, you know, and exactly to your point, things that were unexpectedly great, like yeah. Guardians of the Galaxy. If they can't pull that off every time, if they can't maintain that, I know it sounds like I'm holding them to an impossible standard, considering they were so successful, then their audience is going to feel, you know, betrayed or left behind. That has nothing to do with the way in which they enjoy it, the way that they do it, because yes, some people are watching it, you know, look, you know, people have been watching movies on crappy screens on airplanes for a long yeah. time. They're still watching them on crappy screens on airplanes. And I see plenty of people watching on their phones and iPads on an airplane.
Guilty as charged. I am that person.
I don't necessarily think that it's impossible to enjoy a movie in a less than ideal circumstance, but to say that that's how people always want to watch it or choose to watch it, and that's the reason something's not popular, blaming the format, blaming that, you know, the mindset of the person, I think that's a fail. You know, Quibi, with like their whole business model was based on this. Their whole business model said that, oh, people want to watch it this way now. We're going to do this. I don't think it really took a brain surgeon to realize that that was false. And I think that as people keep perpetuating the stereotype or this idea that Gen Z can't sit down and watch a 2-hour movie, it's a cop-out. But, you know, my kids love to sit down and watch a movie. And I think there's a lot of, like, my daughter went out to go see Princess Mononoke last yeah. night in the theater with another friend of hers, and their whole family, they're all, you know, 12-year-old Gen Zs. You know, it's like they absolutely loved going and having that experience. And they'd seen Princess Mononoke, I don't know how many times, but it was like, you know, that was an experience for them to go do it. I think that ultimately what you're making, I hate to use the word content, but content is king. What the quality of what it is that you're doing is omnipotent. That is what people are going to turn out for. And to blame the format and that people don't want to see something this way.
Well, to blame the generation. I mean, like, yeah. you know, when we were teenagers, that was the rap. And I sort of feel like that's always the rap on new technology and the youngest generation, you know? And I feel like we all got kind of used to people bagging on millennials, and then later it's on Gen Z. And I also think that it's like, you know, we're going to blame when we were kids.
Oh, Gen X got ragged on too. We absolutely
Well, that's what I'm
did.
Saying. When we yeah, were kids, yeah. they would say, you're all, you know, you're watching TV or you're listening to that rap music and it's rotting your brain.
We were slackers. Yeah. You couldn't get anything done. Yeah.
It's like whenever someone in the age bracket that is parents or grandparents is like, X is rotting your brain. It's like, no, it's not video games. It's not TikTok. It's not YouTube. People still like going to movies. People still like watching movies. I do think that there's a fatigue that sets in when every week Disney Plus has a new Marvel series and they overdid it. And
it's okay for something to go away for a little while and then come back. You know, I guarantee you, if there was a little bit of a hiatus, people would love it again.
Exactly. I mean, like, I think about, you know, like, again, through the Gen X lens, we had the original Superman, the motion picture in, like, what, 1978.
Yeah,
and then
like
what's the next major superhero movie was Batman in 1989, like 11 years later.
Yeah.
And I feel like we can afford to have it more frequently than that. But, you know, like I remember when Marvel initially announced, you know, what the MCU was going to be and Kevin Feige and all that stuff. And it was like, yeah, they're going to make like 20 something movies by 2021. And I was like, good Lord. And they did it. And it was very successful. But also, I think it should be said that a lot of the early films were auteur driven. So they would bring in people like Kenneth Branagh, you know, and obviously the aforementioned Jon Favreau to direct these things. And supposedly Jon Favreau after Iron Man 2 was like, peace out. I can't do this anymore. I mean, like, they've gotten some really good people, really talented people in there, like Scott Derrickson, obviously Sam Raimi with Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. Like, I think that there's some good work going on.
Like, they clearly have a great team. It's just, you know, it's comments like that make me go, you know, I think it's someone looking out for their own job. It's you know, the Russos saying you can't blame us. And I think ultimately,
I mean, I never blamed the Russos, you know, like,
I know, but that sounds like what they're saying. It sounds like they're saying, yeah, don't blame us. It's, you know, there's nothing we can do. And it's like, ultimately, I mean, it's just feels tone deaf.
Yeah. I really just feel like at the end of the day, you have to service the audience you have, not the audience you wish you had. And this is something that doing theater for years really got deep into my bones, because it's like, you could say, we have the funniest play ever, but when it goes out in front of an audience and it doesn't get a laugh, it's not like those people showed up because they wanted to have a miserable time. They showed up with the expectation of your play is the best version of what you told them it was going to be, and then it didn't make them laugh. And you have to go, okay, what did we do wrong? And you know, wipe yourself off and, you know, cry yourself to sleep and complain to your spouse, and then you do it again. You know, the problem with like an MCU level thing is it's like every time you do it again is another $150 million. But I actually feel like maybe getting back down to basics, you know, instead of just trying to continue the story endlessly. I actually think the DC model works in a weird way better, because even though I guess with the James Gunn plan, there's going to be like a new version of the DC cinematic universe, whatever they're calling it. But in addition, you know, you've got the Batman, which exists outside of that. You've got Joker, which exists outside of that. And when we get a new Joker movie, if you liked the first Joker, I bet the second Joker movie does pretty well, because it doesn't feel mass produced. It feels very bespoke and made with an auteurish vision behind it. And I actually, you know, always kind of respected that about DC, even though I didn't necessarily love all of their films. You know, yeah. I love that they were willing to say, like, okay, Christopher Nolan, make a Batman trilogy. Okay, Zack Snyder, like, you know, they're handing it to people who have a real point of view.
That is for sure. I really think it's interesting when we get these crossovers like James Gunn or Ryan Reynolds or people who've kind of spent time in both of them. It kind of makes me actually more curious like what they're going to do next, because, you know, both of them are working on more, you know, more Marvel stuff. So,
well, yeah. And, you know, Ryan Reynolds, we're talking of like what, 2 weeks ago, they dropped the new Deadpool and Wolverine trailer and it looks awesome. Like,
yeah.
I just think that, like, when you give an audience something that's like fresh and different, I mean, even though I guess it's hard to call Deadpool different because there have been two Deadpools already, but something that's a little bit out of the mainstream of what you're doing. I mean, I think that's what made Guardians of the Galaxy work, is that it was awesome and surprising. Anyway, that's the end of my soapbox. Love the Russo brothers, love their work, but you can't blame the audience for not showing up to movies.
Agreed. And let's get to the interview with the team behind Hundreds of Beavers.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
So I guess the first question is to you, Mike, but it's, where did the idea for Hundreds of Beavers come from? What's the genesis of it?
Well, it was 5 years ago. It came out of Bar Talk mostly. And I think we'd had a lot of ideas and we chose the one that fit the available resources. Quinn and I and Ryland, the co-writer and star, are all from Wisconsin. So we had a lot of friends that were comfortable with snow. I've been working in After Effects for a long time, so we were comfortable making a very effects-heavy movie. And then we just like physical comedy. So this was a project that combined all of our interests and available resources. And hopefully, you know, we would go somewhere that people wouldn't follow, which was the North Woods of Wisconsin and a dialogue-free movie.
What do you mean go somewhere people wouldn't follow?
I don't know. I haven't had my eye on the indie space too closely, but I don't think there's a lot of snow exterior silent films.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't. Well, actually, I don't know anything about the Wisconsin indie film scene. A guy I went to film school with actually lives up there, but I don't think he's doing anything in the film world anymore. What is the film scene in Wisconsin? What's it like?
Quinn.
Yeah, you know, I spent a long time there. I was born in Milwaukee, and I worked there for about 29 years, basically, until I moved to Los Angeles. But the film scene there is actually pretty up and coming. It has a pretty robust independent scene and also a pretty robust documentary scene as well. So it's definitely on the up and up. But I was really happy to be a part of this and still have it, you know, be sort of an LA-based production, but it's shot in Milwaukee, or Wisconsin, rather. So it's a pretty vibrant community in Wisconsin. You know, I'm not as in touch with it nowadays as I used to be, but you know, I get back fairly often, so I know a lot of friends that are still making films there and doing very well. So
that's really cool. Like, you know, I feel like especially the current technology landscape allows for every locality to kind of have its own vibrant film production world, which inevitably leads to, you know, people doing interesting and creative stuff. And while I was watching this film, it felt to me like I definitely am hearing what you're saying, Mike, about, like, you know, using After Effects, but it almost felt like every technique I could imagine was being used, if I'm not mistaken. Like, it looked like there might have been some miniature work. It looked like there was definitely some green screen work. It looked like there were definitely cool VFX. There's I'm assuming that when I see these massive scenes with dozens or hundreds of beavers, literally from the title, but all the beavers, that you're replicating suits that, you know, you didn't have. You know, if it were my production, I'd be like, maybe we'll get 5 to 10 suits. Like, you know, there were specific scenes, like there was some action stuff towards the end where I'm like, I think that they all have to be in the same room and those all have to be beavers, people in beaver suits. But like, kind of give me a sense of like, how scaled back was the production? Like, what were your constraints? As I've read online, the budget was like 150 grand. I don't know if that's really true, but I gather that it wasn't, you know, throw all the money at it in the world kind of a film.
Yes, it was a small film for 150 grand, and it was a lot of planning and storyboards and effects shots, switching effects styles from shot to shot. Often, because there was 1,500 After Effects shots, there's even more After Effects elements required to be collected by Quinn.
Yeah.
So this whole movie is like a shot on the GH5, and it's Quinn collecting effects elements for me and After Effects, basically. We saw it as like the entire thing was like it was like all pickups almost. Am I wrong, Quinn? Like,
it was a lot. There were a lot of pickup days for sure. And when I first talked to Mike about this project, and he had mentioned they had shot the first act before I was involved on the GH5, and I was sort of a curmudgeon at the time about DSLR. But I was like, okay, we're gonna need all this equipment. We're gonna be out in the middle of nowhere. It's gonna be 0 degrees. We need big batteries. We need like support.
I'd be afraid the camera would freeze. I'd be afraid that the camera would just shut down. Freeze,
you know, but I was really surprised. And Mike's like, oh no, we just use the stock batteries. That's all we used, like 6
And you didn't have problems with camera freezes?
Not at all. The camera worked totally fine. I really kind of changed my opinion on DSLRs in general, but in particular that GH5 worked super well. And really, it's a practicality matter at the end of the day as well, because you are just kind of overburdened with having to load into a remote location, and you don't want necessarily an Arri package if you don't have a full AC crew with you.
How much crew did you have, like on an average day? When you say every day felt like a pickup day, like when I hear pickup, it's like under 20 people, maybe under 10 people. How much crew did you have on a day-to-day basis, do you think?
Like a core of 6, would you say, like on the whole. We had had days where we would have more crew come in or more talent come in for larger scenes, but really up in that cabin up in northern Wisconsin, it was like there were 6 of us.
I think it was a core of 4, actually. I think it was Eric, Max for that second winter, at least when we shot the second act. That was Eric, Max, Ryland, and you and I, right? That's a core of four, often up to six or seven.
Yeah. Mm. So it kind of fluctuates depending on the day, because it was, you know, we had only a limited number of space in the cabin. But yeah, so it was a lean crew, but we accomplished a lot, and very unique experience in that we are shooting this film. It's very intricate. Mike had done 2 years of storyboarding ahead of time. He had a binder, a thick binder of just storyboards. And we would just say, okay, we got to get through these 5 pages today, 8 pages, whatever it is, make this happen. Here's the shot. Here's the angle. Here's the space we have to leave for this practical element or this VFX element, and just go out and execute it. So that's where like having a small camera package comes in. It's just, it's less to manage, you know, with it. From a gear standpoint, it worked out totally fine.
And the GH5, that's a Micro Four Thirds. So you're not having to deal with focus issues too much, right?
Right. It's a little bit more lenient that way. We had two lenses.
What were they? What were the lenses?
I think we had a 14, and then it was like an 18 to 70 or something like that. Mike has the kit. I haven't seen it, but that's all we need.
I don't know anything about cameras. I just randomly bought something with our first when we went out that first winter. It was just Rylan and Eric and I, and like a few mascot costumes. And I just bought the GH5 and the wide, like the Chinese plastic wide lens, and then the lens it came with, and a drone. And I'm not like a big camera guy.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it's funny that all this stuff being effects like meant that Quinn was like, I always felt bad. I'm like, sorry, this shoot isn't more creative. We're just tediously executing these drawings.
It was very creative though, in a way. Like it was, you know, you want to work with the director and a team that knows what they're doing and has everything planned out and knows exactly what they want. And how we would execute the shots was very creative in itself. And it was very difficult and challenging because of the conditions, but it was also extremely just rewarding and satisfying because we would get these shots. And Mike, at the end of every shoot day, every day, he would edit the footage we shot that day.
Do you do that? How do you have the energy after a day of shooting to go into the edit bay? That always blows me away. You hear stories about Robert Rodriguez and their direct, you know, Steven Soderbergh shooting all day and then going in editing. And it's like you've been out in the freezing cold all day long filming on your feet. How do you go sit down and edit?
It's like it's almost like asking like, how could you spend all that time cooking? You must be so tired from cooking. How could you then sit down and eat a meal?
Except I've spent several days on set, and it's like after a day of set, like I'm like, oh, I got to go to sleep, you know, and then wake up the next day and do it again.
I'll say this. It got dark pretty early because we were shooting in the winter all the way up at the top of Wisconsin. And so I don't know. It was dark at 4:30. So it's not like home at 9 p.m.
We had hard outs because of the light. So, but yeah, Mike would show us edits every night. And for as much and meticulous as every shot was planned, and Mike storyboarded, there were still moments where I'm like, okay, are we getting what we need? Like, it feels kind of fragmented. I don't know. Like, we're just having the talent go in and Mike's shouting out direction at them. And he's like, hold your hand up, spin your arm. And it's just like, okay, I hope we got it. And then it always worked. Mike would show us at the end of the day. I'm like, oh, amazing. Okay. So you know exactly to the T, to the pixel, what he needs. And it was great. Yeah.
I forgot about this. That did buy us. It bought Quinn and I confidence from the team. And so we had a lot of trust because we were doing a really weird movie. But yeah, I kind of forgot about all this. But yeah, doing the post at the end of the day made everyone trust Quinn and I more.
It's a great morale boost for everyone, you know, just so we know, okay, we're getting what we need and it's coming together. And seeing it, you know, at the end of the day is such an immediate way to just be satisfied with what we're getting. So very unique in that sense.
And there's no proxies. We're like shooting in 1080p. So everything goes right in and edits immediately. And you can do temp effects in Premiere and it runs full speed.
That's pretty cool. I'm a big Adobe user too. And I, you know, I can see the value, especially in something like this where you're going to have this effects heavy thing to have the integration that Adobe gives you to just jump back in and out of After Effects. Cause there's, I mean, like, I don't know how many shots in that movie didn't have some kind of effect on them, you know, like it feels very affected. And I wanted to ask you just even like from the basic construction of the movie, did you start with the script? Did you start with a storyboard? What did you show people? When you talk about how you had a massive binder of storyboards, it makes me think of like George Miller and Mad Max Fury Road. And the movie you're making has, you know, well, it's basically a silent film. It has virtually no dialogue in it anyway. It kind of reminded me of, like, I don't know if you've ever seen the Canadian filmmaker Guy Maddin. He makes these homages to silent films like Tales from the Gimli Hospital. And it had that kind of a vibe to it, but that plus, like, the wackiest Warner cartoons or Tom and Jerry kind of cartoon feeling. So it's like so kinetic. What does the script get you versus the storyboards? Like, I feel like the storyboards would be the whole story. Am I crazy?
Yeah, we sold the movie based, or we collected shares just based on a treatment, much like Fury Road, just a written treatment. That's how we got the money, along with a little deck of and a compilation of visual influences. Guy Maddin's a direct influence because
I'm glad I caught that. I love Guy Maddin's work.
Yeah, and for us, it's also just the freedom of picking a grainy black and white style is frees you up to tell a bigger story and to have bigger visual ideas. And so just by working in that look, it just frees up the whole writing process, the same way the South Park writers are freed by the simplicity of their style to have any ideas they want.
Yeah.
And work and execute them quickly. This style gave us that, and Guy Maddin kind of just gave us permission to work that way in the modern day. Yeah, the boards were done as we were collecting money. And then, yeah, I think we got, after the first winter of shooting the solo Fur Trapper scenes from Act One, then Quinn came on board, and the movie had to be shot by Quinn. Like, there's literally no one else that could have done it.
How did you guys know each other?
We'd met at the Milwaukee Film Festival back in 2018, like October 2018, right before I moved out to Los Angeles. I was still living in Milwaukee at the time. And Mike and Ryland were showing their previous feature, Lake Michigan Monster. So that's how we met. And then we hit it off and stayed in touch when we moved out to Los Angeles, and that was it.
Yeah, it couldn't have been anybody but Quinn, because Quinn was used, he's just a tough guy and he's used to the winter. And like all these shots had to be like on a ladder in the snow, because we're getting all these high angle shots to like bring out the silhouette of the character against the white snow. So we're always going like up on a ladder, matching like a cartoon, and it's like negative 15 and there's no crew. And so it's like, Quinn, you have to carry the ladder onto the frozen river and then set it up yourself. And if your skin touches it, it'll rip your skin off.
Oh man.
And you got to get up there. Now it's less than negative 15 because you're getting hit by wind because you're 10 feet up. And then now you got to get a shot up there and it's got to be framed like my cartoon. And
better
you
than
do
me,
that
man.
For
oh my
nine
God,
weeks.
This is awful. I can't. That just sounds like that's intense. Like, you know, and how many days were you doing this for?
Yeah, it was like what, 8 weeks?
I mean, eight weeks. Wow.
There were several stints over, like, we did like 2 weeks in January 2021, then three in February of that year, and then Mike had shot the whole first act for the previous winter. It was amazing. I mean, it was, for as challenging as it was, again, it wasn't without purpose. And we knew what we had to accomplish, and we were very motivated and driven and based. We knew what we were getting. We knew, we saw the edits and we're like, let's just keep going. It's looking amazing. It's visually, it's working out. I mean, no one's as tough as Ryland, first of all. Like, that guy is just out there in the snow, naked.
Yeah, when I started watching it, I was like, is this green screen? I'm like, no, that is real. He's really in snow. And I'm a Floridian, so it's hard for me to imagine being in anything but all of my clothes all at once if I was in like moderate snow. So I can't imagine being like, you know, up in, you know, northern Wisconsin in that kind of weather, you know, basically naked. Like, that was crazy.
Yeah, it was inspiring. He crushed it. He was always ready to go and never slowed down. You know, there was like certain times we'd forget to call cut and he would just keep acting while Mike and I were discussing. Like, he's still there. Oh, shit. Sorry, Ryland. Cut.
You needed the two department. You needed Ryland and Quinn to be really tough guys to just sort of set an example for anyone else that came on set too. Sorry, the core team was five. It was Ryland, Quinn, and I, Eric, and Max for those that winter shoot. So it was a five-person crew, basically, with some special guests rolling in and out.
Mike, how did you keep, because you have this massive continuity in your head, and when you're on a film crew, it's, you know, hard for everyone else to even know where you are in the story if you're doing stuff out of sequence. I don't know how much of it you did in sequence. How did you keep everyone tuned into what the scene was, where it belonged? Did you go over the boards every day? Was there an animatic? Did you build an animatic so people could see what you were doing?
Yeah, people could watch the animatic on the DIT computer, and they could also see the boards in my binders that I was carrying around.
Yeah.
But it still takes a lot of explaining and is a lot to wrap your head around, because there's so much in this movie.
It is a lot.
I was just thinking about it nonstop for years. That's the answer. And then just doing my best to explain it to the team. And then just always surprised how much trust we got from like Eric and Max and everybody. Like we just, the team just really believed that like Quinn and I knew what we were collecting.
And how much of it was in a studio? I mean, there's stuff, especially towards the end when you have this kind of electrifying climax in this beaver compound, you're riding on logs, you're doing all these like really sophisticated sequences, like, you know, it feels like something right out of a Warner cartoon, but you're using mixtures of live action. I don't know if there were miniatures, you know, there was definitely flat art and stuff in there. How much of that was done like on a green screen stage, or how did you accomplish that stuff?
Well, the log flume chase was kind of interesting, Quinn, when we were just, Ryland had was moving out of his apartment, and we just had an apartment for 3 days. And we put green up on two walls and the floor.
You're kidding me, really?
The entire like sneaking into the castle and the log flume thing was
holy
shot
crap.
In 3 days.
That was all green screen, the log flume chase and the beaver dam infiltration sequence. So the lodge infiltration. So, but it is funny because watching the movie, it is hard to know like what's real, what's fake, what's an element. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not, you know, but by and large, I think we shot most of it on location. We would set up, and then sometimes we would like set up a green screen on a goalpost, 2C stands with a tarp, just kind of in the woods to get, you know, if we're trying to comp in Ryland, like, you know, walking across whatever surface. So while like much of it was shot practically, it was also, you know, obviously there's a lot of digital elements. So it's very unique that way, because typically like a lot of these movies, you know, will be 95% shot in a studio or, you know, really shot in a studio. But this is, you know, we're out there. We're out there in the elements and we're scouting locations. And it was such a great thing too. It's very therapeutic in that sense. You're just very focused in the middle of it. It's very rare to be in a production where you are not only making a movie and having to, you know, use all your energy and focus and creativity and meditate on how to accomplish certain looks and goals and shots and whatever, but you're also trying to not die a lot of the time. You know, all of us almost died at least once, I would say. So oh, it's a very unique experience in that way. Extremely rewarding. I can't say that enough, honestly. But it was amazing. Yeah. So we've all been on shoots where it's horrible conditions and the movie's not that great, unfortunately, or it's not
for sure.
Well, so that can be very abysmal, but this was, you know, it was such a great experience in that regard. Like I was very happy to kind of finally be a part of a production where it's like, okay, we have a true leader, a true team. Mike and Ryland have been making movies together since they were, you know, teenagers.
Was there like an aura around it? Like, did you know you were working on something? I mean, like, I feel like there's no way to have worked on something like this and not known this is completely out of the ordinary. Yeah. You know, like this is not the use. You got, you know, these people standing around in beaver costumes and raccoon costume, you know, these mascot looking things. But like, did you have a sense of like, no, this is going to be something people are going to really appreciate. Like it's going to break through.
No question. And I mean, I had seen Mike and Ryland's previous film and I was like, okay, they are extremely talented and they know what they want, know what they're doing, very clear in their decision-making. And Mike called me October 2020 in Los Angeles when things are, you know, everything's locked down. And I'm like, Mike was very upfront about, okay, we're doing this movie and it's going to be 0 degrees. It's going to be kind of brutal, but you know, maybe you're going to feel like a camera operator a lot of the days because we're just executing what we have. And I'm like, please, let's do it. I'm so excited. Let's get started. Yeah. Everyone knew very early on that it was going to be something special and people seem to have responded to it pretty well.
Well, and one of the things that I really appreciated about it, and I guess this is more for you, Mike, is that, you know, I feel like the first, whatever, 5-10 minutes of any movie teach you how to watch the movie. And in those first 5-10 minutes, you throw every technique but the kitchen sink at us. Can you tell me, because I'm presuming, but like, what were all the techniques? Like, obviously, there's animation, there's green screen, there's, I think, miniatures, there's creature suits and stuff like that. Like, what were all the techniques that you kind of had in your head that you wanted to explore when you did this?
They came in one by one. We had the ideas first and then solved problems around the gag ideas that we'd had. So we didn't go through a checklist of techniques we wanted to combine. We just were saying, oh, there's got to be a frog. That should be a puppet we're going to have to order. Some things are custom props. Some things are just a Shutterstock image. Some things are going to be like really cheap little YouTube effects. Other things we're going to pay for a rocket model and it's going to be really sophisticated and we're going to get a real model guy, Patricio Wolovich. And some of these things are just going to be mascot costumes ordered from China. Others, you know, that are cheap. Others are going to be like custom props. A lot of this is going to have a practical plate shot in the snow, but then the elements on top of that can be all kinds of fake. And as long as you're making the location stuff look a little fake and the and you're making the fake stuff look a little real, hopefully it all meets in the middle, kind of in movie world. I really like the film The Mighty Joe Young, the original movie, because it switches between a bunch of different styles. It switches between stop motion, live action, miniature, rear projection, all these different things. But it switches between the styles quickly and using every style in like every other shot. So it has a sleight of hand. And even though any one shot is really easy to tell how they did it, it's happening quick enough and it's happening with a consistency to the world where the only way I know to describe it is sleight of hand. If you're switching techniques quickly enough, the audience just accepts movie world.
Yeah, and a more modern director that I also was thinking of when I was watching it was Sam Raimi, and how, you know, in Evil Dead 2 or Army of Darkness, he'll go from rear screen projection to front screen projection to miniature to stop motion. And yeah, I mean, it was just kind of like a kitchen sink approach, you know, whereas I feel like these days the approach is usually like, okay, well, you're making a big budget Marvel movie or whatever, and it's going to be like, okay, you know, Robert Downey Jr. is going to talk to a tennis ball and later there's going to be a robot there or whatever. And yeah. I feel like the integration of all those, you know, like I feel like, you know, you're in the hands of someone who really knows what they're doing when you see when it does what you're describing. You know, it goes from a green screen to I don't know what you call the technique, but it's like, you know, it's basically stop motion with a person where they're just kind of popping around and stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Pixelation. Yeah, so like, you know, we try to have Rylan reacting to an animal in a suit is real enough. It gets it's very tactile. And then, but if you switch to a stupid looking blender carrot in the next shot,
yeah,
it's all right because it's wedged between two shots that are something real. Like, I think about that with Lord of the Rings a lot. Like, you know what CGI looks really good is CGI that's between two practical shots and cut well.
Yeah. No, that's actually great advice. I feel like that's, you know, because it's, again, it's easy enough to be like, well, we'll just fix it all in post. But I feel like you just had it all so mapped out. So did you make an animatic of like the whole film before you even started? Like, you knew shot for shot everything?
Yeah, it was done act by act, but before every shoot, I had the boards, and it was an animatic with some temp sound on it. Bob had started engineering some of the repeating signature sounds before the shoot, and I had those laid in there and a little scratch audio sometimes. And then, you know, in Storyboard Pro, you can export to QuickTime or to a PDF. Mm-hmm. And so the same board that I drew worked as our on-set shot list PDF. And also as the base of the premiere timeline.
That's amazing. I mean, I feel like it's really inspirational, especially for, you know, anyone who's listening to this podcast who maybe is in film school or thinking about going into film school or trying their hand at this stuff, because preparedness doesn't cost you anything. It takes your time. But just kind of getting people to believe in the project, like, that's something that you honestly can't. You couldn't buy that. Like, when people are all moving in the same direction, and it sounds like, you know, on this, if everyone wasn't moving in the same direction, it would have been really hard to keep everybody kind of focused outside in the snow and the elements and stuff like that. Like, that just sounds like a humongous challenge. Now, there were some scenes, especially towards the end, there's like that trial scene. I assumed you must have been like replicating the beavers, and also, you know, there's the giant chase scene across the the ice floes and all that stuff. Where, you know, it's literally hundreds of suits. How many suits did you have in total? I'm just really curious about that. Do you know?
Just six. The only time they all appear on screen is in the fight scene.
Yeah.
That trial scene is also, the light sources were kind of, that was the first time I tried actually writing the light sources into the boards to try to create a consistency to this like fake space and to try and use the black void as like a big space. And this is a technique I really want to do with Quinn and Fidel moving forward. So that, you know, the trial scene for me is a trial run of a style I'd like to do more. And so Quinn was like the one man lighting team on that thing, keeping in his head straight where these sources were and where we are in the fake space for this element. Because the direction, Quinn, like, help me just explain this. Like, the direction that you're shooting, the direction you put the subject in the camera is unrelated to the directionality in the fake space. It's just how to best fit this shot into the barn. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
And yeah, so you have to be very cognizant of like the light source and the angle of the shot. So if you're shooting one element, one beaver, it's like, okay, well, that's great. But then we have to be cognizant, okay, the light source is here, the projector. I think there was a projector source in that. So we had like a Leico just like spotted in, and we had to make sure that it's on the right side of frame when we shoot and they're looking frame left. So you have to make sure you orient yourself. There was a lot of discussion on set as to the screen direction and making sure that was consistent, as well as the lighting consistency, very crucial. But it was so that lighting was more stylized, even though it was more green screen still. A lot of black void shooting that we did for that. But the lighting was very deliberate. And you can feel that. Like, it's interesting, Mike. I think I'm kind of reminded that you said, okay, now it's like, it was your first time writing in the lighting to the scene. So that definitely, you can feel that when you watch it too. Because it is combining, you still have the, you know, green screen elements. It feels very VFX heavy, but also very deliberate as far as the light and the consistency and the tone of that and the stylized nature of that. So it's like very film noir, very, very dark and edgy. But
this is getting me excited to like shoot again. I mean, we haven't shot a movie Quinn gets to be on set. I've been doing these interviews and releasing the stupid Beaver movie, but like I haven't been set since when, Quinn? Since in 3 years.
Yeah, like March 21, maybe.
Yeah, this is like taking me back to how nice it was to just be on a really dedicated team in the woods and have one goal in mind and be on a ship on a long journey and just work it towards something. I don't know. That's a good feeling. All this post and spending a year and a half releasing the movie, you know, this isn't the art. This is like something marketing is like something you have to do. But like, I don't know. This is making me miss being on set, Quinn. It was a real pleasure.
You guys, I have to say, you guys make it sound like a lot of fun. And you know, there are days on set that feel like work and there are days that feel like fun. And when I was watching the movie, that sense of fun was palpable to me. Like you watch a movie like this and there's no way that you watch this and go, wow, I bet that was a real drag. Like you had to be cracking up constantly because what you were doing was just such a high level of absurdity.
That's a good question. Was it funny on set, Quinn?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I just thinking about it now, it's like we would never without direction. You and Ryland are like have boundless energy. We always knew what we were doing. And like, I don't remember ever even fighting or arguing, mainly because we don't have time. Because if you argue, you'll just freeze to death.
Did you ever like just stop and look at what you were doing and the people in the Beaver mascot costumes or whatever? And just the hilariousness of, you know, we're grown adult college graduated people and this is what we're doing.
And just a moment and you're like, oh, what are we like?
Just
like,
no, but just like appreciate the fact that you get to do something this awesome and offbeat and different, you know, like I feel like it's a film people are going to be referencing for years.
That's really kind of you to say. When we were doing it, it's just a lot of work. And then it's just absurd that you're like putting on a stupid Beaver costume and standing in the snow. And then it's like very slow and cold. And the absurdity doesn't really hit you until you run into somebody else up there. And they're like, what are you doing? And you're like, I don't know.
Yeah. One scene I remember I was laughing so hard. It's when Jay showed up for the day and we were filming them as beavers in that deep snow, like carrying the log over the hill in the river. They were in like up to their heads in snow, basically carrying these logs for this shot. And Mike's like, just keep going. And they can't move. They're like buried and just like rolling. There were so many moments like that. I remember I was just like laughing out loud.
That day with Sub-Zero, we dragged everything down into the gorge, into the Black River Falls. It took forever. It took so long to set that shot up. And by the time they're out there with the big fake log and they've got their costumes on and they just have to walk across the shot and it's like their snow is going to be ruined, so they can only do it once. And I'm just like, whatever you do, don't stop and take the heads off to look around. You have to keep going. So it's immediately they get stuck and James is like goes to take his head off to look around at what's happening. And I'm just like, no, you can't do that. Keep the head on. Keep going. Under no circumstances can you take the head off. Do your best. So there was a lot of precise animation, but there's also just, there were some things like that are just funny. If you just set up a situation and you say, do your best, you know, travel across the frame in this stupid costume and, do you know, if you try your hardest, it'll just be funny because you're gonna fail.
that's a great quote. I want a t-shirt that says that. All right, well, guys, I my time here is almost up. Before we go, Hundreds of Beavers is coming out on VOD, right?
Yes, platforms? It's available now for digital rent and download on Amazon and Apple. but you should go to hundredsofbeavers.com and see if it's playing at a theater in your area, because it's a lot of fun to watch with a group.
Ooh, I wonder if it's playing out here. I'll get a group of people.
Yeah, and if it's not playing in your area, you can submit a request for an indie theater, if you know an indie theater near you, or you can invite some friends over for the digital rental.
That's a good idea. I wish we had even started with talking about pushing indie theaters to do it, because I feel like this would be, I used to be a projectionist at an indie theater in Florida, and I feel like this is exactly the kind of thing that like a midnight crowd would just go crazy for. And before we go, you just mentioned your website. Where can people find both of you online?
I'm on Instagram at Quinn.Hester on Instagram. That's my best resource right now.
Yeah, I think it's just my name. It's just Mike Cheslick on Instagram. Yeah, the handle is Mike Ches, and my name is Mike Cheslick. I'm on Instagram.
Excellent, excellent. Well, congratulations, guys. I know it was a lot of work, and Mike, I hope you get back on set as soon as possible and make another film. I can't wait to see what this leads to. I hope it leads to way bigger things for you, budget-wise at least. And congratulations. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
All right, so that was Mike Cheslick and Quinn Hester. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show. Congratulations on Hundreds of Beavers. I hope everybody listening to the sound of my voice runs out and sees it in the theater if you can, if it's still playing in the theater that near you.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it. I'm glad that you gave such a rich endorsement. I can't wait to have her.
Thank Alana, because she was the one who got us the interview, Alana Cody, but also it's definitely the kind of movie that I would seek out. It's totally my speed, but I also think that I know that my speed maybe isn't everyone's speed, but I think this is the kind of thing where I defy you to not be entertained by this movie. It's so fun.
And now, Short Ends.
So, Ilya, it is our patent-pending segment of Short Ends, where we talk about our pet obsessions of the week. What you got? What's your obsession this week?
I'm really enjoying a series. It's on Hulu, and it's called Shogun. It is technically, I guess, a remake or a reboot of... it was like a 1980s series. I never watched it.
I remember it existing, but it was an adaptation of a book, right?
Adaptation of a book. And so maybe technically this is just a different adaptation of that book, but it's been really good. It's a little bit of a historical drama biopic that is set against this sort of like feudal Japan 1600s with like the Portuguese and the British sort of, I shouldn't say discovering, but discovering Japan like as like another territory and trying to open up trade routes. And there is all of this political drama and like samurai sword fighting sort of like giant battles and clashes, and it has been surprisingly well put together. It's a well shot show. It's clearly shot in anamorphic, and it's a lovely looking show. It's got really solid performances. It's probably about 50% in Japanese, 50% in English. Of course, it's subtitled, but it's really kind of a nice melding. I feel like we have an embarrassment of like good Japanese English shows right now between this and Tokyo Vice. I'm kind of beside myself. Two good series, sort of like one right after another. If you haven't tried Shogun, I would say give it a watch. You'll know if you like it after an episode or two, for sure. Mm. It's got a lot of good stuff in it.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I've been meaning to check it out, and as I have told you, I've been just super busy, and I get to that point with work where my brain is too full to take on a series of like real complexity.
It's on Hulu, so if you have Hulu, you can check it out. Ben, what is your short end this week?
Well, it's not something that everyone can just go experience very easily. You have to be in Southern California. But last week for my son's 6th birthday, so for people who've been listening to the show long enough, you remember when he was born. and I edited the Johnny Durango interview in the hospital while my wife was getting ready to give birth.
I think you took a couple weeks off after that, if I recall correctly.
I did, but I remember like sitting there because, we were there for like 3 days and I didn't have anything to do. And I had my laptop and I had Johnny Durango's interview. And I'm like, hey, I can be semi-productive here and cut Johnny's interview. That's how long ago it was. Feels like last week and feels like 500 years. Anyway, so my son turned 6 and we took him to Disney's California Adventure and regular old Disneyland. And I had never been to either one of them because I grew up in Orlando, Florida, and I have been to Disney 10 billion times. Every time, you know, the cousins were in from out of town, it was like, hey, we got to go to Disney. And if it's possible, I got kind of bored with it.
When I was in London, not to interrupt and derail it, I asked my buddy who's there, I said, Will, do you ever go to football matches? And he's like, oh, only when Americans come to town.
Yeah. And the entire time I've lived in LA, I've never once been like, ooh, I wonder what it'd be like to go to one of those. I've been to like Knott's Berry Farm and Six Flags and stuff like that. But anyway, we took him there and I hadn't been to a theme park in years, in decades. And I was shocked by the production value, pleasantly shocked by the high quality production value. And I have to say too, you know, like I freelance for Disney.
You subscribe to Disney Plus?
I do subscribe to Disney Plus, but I would not put myself down as like one of those Disney fan people. Mm. I don't own a pair of mouse ears. You know, I'm
not an annual pass holder. You don't
know. No. This is like the first time. But the new rides, the newer rides there, like the Star Wars area of Disneyland is, I'm a Star Wars fan a little bit, but I'm not like a massive Star Wars geek. And the Star Wars stuff there was insane. Like it was like walking into a Star Wars movie. Wow. It was so good.
And bar raised?
Very much so. And they had two Star Wars based rides that we went on. Smuggler's Run, where basically you're piloting the Millennium Falcon, and Rise of the Resistance. Rise of the Resistance, I would say, is easily the best theme park ride I've ever seen in my life, I've ever been on. It's so freaking great. And it's the way that they integrate. Some of it looks like a hologram, but I suspect it's just a really high resolution video image projected against a scrim, but it looks like it's sitting in 3D space. But they'll mix that kind of thing with amazing animatronic robots. Like there's an Admiral Ackbar robot there. There's a Kylo Ren robot that are extremely interactive. Also, in the case of Rise of the Resistance, there's like human actors who like lead you in, and you're basically supposedly rebels who were caught by the First Order and they're going to do terrible things to you. And then you're broken out and you escape in these little cars. And it's like, as you're going around, just, you know, apropos of nothing, hey, there's, you know, two full-size Imperial walkers in a room that you go into and you're like, what? You know, it's like the amount of detail, like you really do feel like you're in a short film based in the Star Wars world. Wow. And the video quality is astonishing. The audio quality, that level, you know, like in that one alone, like Daisy Ridley is in it. Oscar Isaac is in it. And Admiral Ackbar, there's like a, you know, a robotic Admiral Ackbar that looks as good as the real one in the movie. And it's just
even better because he's in 3D right in front of you.
Yeah, he's right in front of you. Just amazing. The showmanship that they've gotten to. And in California Adventure, like I'm not even the world's biggest fan of the animated movies, the Cars movies, but they recreated Radiator Springs in California Adventure. And the level of detail and the quality of it, it's just mind-boggling. Like it's hard to even look at it. Like your tickets to Disney are expensive, no doubt.
Very expensive. Your wallet is significantly lighter, I'm sure, having spent 2 days there.
But I will say that, like, you know, when you go into any one of these things, you go like, how many tens of millions of dollars did this ride cost to design and create and build and continue to staff? And you and I were talking before we got on here about the Indiana Jones ride, which I'd never been on. And it's that level of quality and that level of detail. And in the Indiana Jones ride, I just kind of got a sense of like, how enormous is this ride? This ride is like an airplane hangar sized ride. And the sets are outrageously detailed.
So your short end is go to Disney and experience all the crazy art direction that is now you and the imagine. You know, they do employ these Disney Imagineers who it's their whole job to wow you. It's their whole job to come up
and
with this.
And it's working, you know, like as a filmmaker, I'm like looking at, you know, like on the Guardians of the Galaxy ride, there's like crazy high, I don't know what the resolution is, might be 8K video where they got like all of the Guardians of the Galaxy characters and film them, and they have, you know, Rocket is CGI animated at a level at or above what you see in the movies, and it all plays with the ride that you're on. And so I understand sort of how, if you're a filmmaker and you're making video that has to work in another medium, so the you're not the medium that you're making it for isn't film. You're making it. My friend in Seattle owns an escape room called Hourglass Escapes, and he did an Evil Dead 2 escape room. And several years ago, I went up there and did a bunch of video for him for that as a giant Evil Dead 2 nerd. That was a lot of fun. And also Seth Wolfson, who owns it, he's a good friend of mine. And it's like you have to, as a filmmaker, say like, what I'm making isn't the main show here. What I'm, you know, the main show in that case is an escape room. In the case of the theater that I've done, it's a play, and the video has to enhance the play, not distract from the play. And the level of filmmaking that's going on in these, I don't know who's making these films. I'm sure it's not James Gunn, you know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they bring James Gunn in, or, you know, whatever, you know, J.J. Abrams to do Rise of the Resistance. But I'm sure it's somebody who's very respectful of those franchises and like what they've built. And at the same time, it just has to function as a piece of a ride. But it's done. Every piece of it is so well put together. The production value is just shocking. Anyway, I'm going to stop waxing Disney's car. I kept thinking like,
it's very shiny now.
I can't imagine any filmmaker today making a theme park with their name on it. Like, it seems like the most egomaniacal thing you could possibly do. But
it was for kids, and he did make kids movies. But I don't know. Maybe someone did start a new, you know, kids movie studio. They could make their own theme park. I don't know. It doesn't seem,
I mean,
so
like
crazy.
I would go to a Miyazaki theme park, but I just don't see it. I don't see him. It would be called like Ghibli Land or something. It wouldn't be called Miyazakiville.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Oh, well, I think, you know, Walt was pretty smart, and then he realized that he was the brand. So yeah. I think he was the brand way back then.
No,
so.
It's just astonishing. And to be fair, also, we only went to like one or two of the older rides, like we did Pirates of the Caribbean, and I didn't love it. But we didn't do
it.
Like,
just didn't hold up to you?
As, didn't do a hall present. You know what? Pirates of the Caribbean has no story. So it's just like you're on a boat lazily looking at a pageant of pirate-themed garbage. And it's all like weird robots. And so, you know, if you like being on a boat inside, it's the best. But, and if you like looking at robots, look at all the robots.
When I was like 9, it was awesome.
Yeah, yeah, I imagine. But when you were 9, Rise of the Resistance didn't exist. When you were 9, they didn't have a full-sized Millennium Falcon built there that you could just walk around.
How did your 6-year-old feel about Pirates of the Caribbean?
I think he was kind of bored.
Yeah. Okay.
He liked Jungle Cruise. That was also kind of old timey. But
that's
like
very old-timey,
his
yeah.
favorite one was Space Mountain.
Wow.
And it's which
What's
has been rebranded as Hyperspace Mountain because they added some Star Wars stuff into it.
Gotcha. Well, Ben, I think that's just about going to do us for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Mm-hmm. Where can people track you down? They want to track you down.
Track me down at benrock.com. You'll find my reel and information about me and all my social media stuff and all that good shit. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Usually find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Also, soon to be Hot Rod Cameras Portland.
Whoa.
Probably about 6 weeks away. We're going to have
really?
A new location here. That's what I'm targeting right now. We're going to do a little soft launch coming up this week. But yeah, 6 weeks, we should have a new retail space. So
that's awesome.
It'll be interesting. Yeah, it's a very different market here. But, you know, I'm looking forward to it. Who do we have to thank this week?
As always, we should thank our awesome producer, Alana Cody, who has us working pretty hard. We've done a bunch of interviews lately, and we're going to be dropping those as we go. We should be thanking our intrepid, hardworking editor, Ben Katz, who works very hard to make neither you nor I sound like the idiots that I'll just say that I am. And people
let's just say how hardworking Ben is a couple more times.
He's hardworking.
Industrious.
Well, yeah. we could say it a few more times, then he can cut it out.
Yeah, that's right.
And last but never least, we should thank Kazal Attrakshi, who composed every scrap of music you heard on the show. Go to his website at musicbykaze.com. Hire him to compose an original score for you. And
he
lots of other stuff that I'm always talking about, directing, color grading, or visual effects.
And you should know that he does compose music that is not necessarily moody synthesizer sort of like techno EDM sort of like you know ours is, you know, he does all flavors of music.
He does
all kinds of cool stuff.
He's a multifaceted composer. I think he's great. So Ilya, you take us out.
If you're watching us on YouTube, thank you. It turns out more and more people keep watching us on YouTube. So I guess I know you hate it, but I'm putting it at the very end where they say you should always put it at the beginning. I'll just say, be kind, subscribe. Kind of like Be Kind Rewind, but Be Kind, subscribe.
Do we need to tell people to smash a like button?
No, we don't. I hate that. You know what? They don't have to. If I feel like if they're going to like it, they will like it. We don't need to remind them.
But you don't have to smash the like button. Nobody smashes the like button.
Your keyboard's going to be broken if you keep smashing it. So anyway, and until next time.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.